Hello, scumbags and scumbagettes. Welcome back to the Scumbag Diaries. In this episode, we are doing a second scumbag comic book industry, and we are going to be talking about Wonder Woman, her creator, BDSM, sexism in the comic book industry, and basically just what happens to someone's work after they die, how it gets changed hands, and what could go wrong, and all the scummy things that might ensue with that. I'm not going to do any comic book movie news or anything or ramble on too much about any upcoming episodes of the podcast, but instead I am going to play you a recording of a reading of Neil Gaiman's Other People. We're doing an episode on Neil Gaiman in the near future, and this is one of my favorite little short things that he's written, and I think that it's just something nice to read and ponder on. And if you guys don't want to listen to it, or you get bored halfway through, which I don't think you will because it's pretty amazing work, just go ahead and fast forward about 7 minutes and you can get back to me rambling on about Wonder Woman and all the craziness in her and Professor Marston's life. Thank you guys for tuning in. I know there's some craziness going on in the world out there, and I hope that this show has been beneficial to you, even if it's just a distraction from all of the chaos in the world. Thanks for tuning in. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Scumbag Comic Book Industry Part 2, Wonder Woman, Sexism, and Bondage.
Time is fluid here, said the demon. He knew it was a demon the moment he saw it. He knew it, just as he knew the place was hell. There was nothing else that either of them could have been. The room was long, and the demon waited by a smoking brazier at the far end. A multitude of objects hung on the rock-gray walls, of the kind that it would not have been wise or reassuring to inspect too closely. The ceiling was low, the floor oddly insubstantial.
Come close, said the demon.
And he did. The demon was rake-thin and naked. He was deeply scarred, and it appeared to have been flayed at some time in the distant past. It had no ears, no sex. Its lips were thin and ascetic, and its eyes were a demon's eyes. They had seen too much and gone too far. And under their gaze, he felt less important than a fly.
What happens now?
He asked.
Now,
said the demon. In a voice that carried with it no sorrow, no relish, only a dreadful flat resignation.
You will be tortured.
For how long?
But the demon shook its head and made no reply. It walked slowly along the wall, eyeing first one of the devices that hung there, then another. At the far end of the wall by the closed door was a cat-o'-nine-tails made by frayed wire. The demon took it down with one three-fingered hand and walked back, carrying it reverently. It placed the wire tines onto the brazier and stared at them as they began to heat up.
That's inhuman.
Yes.
The tips of the cat's tails were glowing a dead orange. As the demon raised his arm to deliver the first blow, it said,
In time, you will remember even this moment in fondness.
You are a liar.
No,
said the demon.
The next part,
it explained in the moment before it brought down the cat,
is worse.
Then the tines of the cat landed on the man's back with a crack and a hiss, tearing through the expensive clothes, burning and rending and shredding as they struck, and not for the last time in the place, he screamed. There were 211 implements on the walls of that room, and in time he was to experience each of them, when finally, the Lazarine's daughter, which he had grown to know intimately, had been cleaned and replaced on the wall in the 211th position. Then, through wrecked lips, he gasped.
Now what?
Now,
said the demon.
The true pain begins.
It did. Everything he had ever done, it had been better left undone. Every lie had told to himself, or told to others. Every little hurt, and all the great hurts. Each one was pulled out of him, detail by detail, inch by inch. The demon stripped away the cover of forgetfulness. stripped away down to truth, and it hurt more than anything.
Tell me what you thought as she walked out of the door,
said the demon.
I thought my heart was broken.
No,
said the demon, without hate.
You didn't.
It stared at him with expressionless eyes, and he was forced to look away.
I thought, now she'll never know I've been sleeping with her sister.
The demon took apart his life, moment by moment, instant to awful instant. It lasted 100 years, perhaps, or 1,000. They had all the time there ever was in that gray room. And toward the end, he realized that the demon had been right. The physical torture had been kinder. And it ended. And once it ended, it began again. There was a self-knowledge there that he had not had the first time, which somehow made everything worse. Now, as he spoke, he hated himself. There were no lies, no evasions, no room for anything except the pain and the anger. He spoke, he no longer wept, and when he finished, 1,000 years later, he prayed that now the demon would go to the wall and bring down the skinning knife or the choke pair or the screws.
Again,
said the demon. He began to scream. He screamed for a long time.
Again,
said the demon when he was done, as if nothing had been said. It was like peeling an onion. The time through his life he learned about consequences. He learned the results of things he had done, things he had been blind to as he did them, the ways he had hurt the world, the damage he had done to people he had never known, or met, or encountered. It was the hardest lesson yet.
Again,
said the demon, 1,000 years later. He crouched on the floor beside the brazier, rocking gently. His eyes closed, and he told the story of his life, re-experiencing it as he told it, from birth to death, changing nothing, leaving nothing out, facing everything. He opened his heart. When he was done, he sat there, eyes closed, waiting for the voice to say,
"Again."
But nothing was said. He opened his eyes. Slowly, he stood up. He was alone. At the far end of the room, there was a door, and as he watched it, it opened. A man stepped through the door. There was terror in the man's face, and arrogance, and pride. The man, who wore expensive clothes, took several hesitant steps into the room, and then stopped. When he saw the man, he understood.
"Time is fluid here,"
he told the new arrival.
Wonder Woman first debuted in All-Star Comics issue number 8 in 1941. She was the very first prominent female superhero. The Golden Age era of Wonder Woman comics contained many articles geared towards bettering the lives of presumed female readership, such as an article on career paths for females in the 1940s, and the Wonder Women of History segment, in which a great female pioneer of history was showcased. Princess Diana of Paradise Island, later to be known as Themyscira, an island inhabited by the strong female race of warriors known as the Amazon, was the daughter of Queen Hippolyta. She was sculpted by her mother out of clay, but was imbued with life force by the Greek gods. She was the strongest of the Amazonians. She grew to be super strong, very brilliant strategist, and the best fighter on the island. One day, an American intelligence agent by the name of Steve Trevor washed up on the shores of Themyscira. She won the right to return Steve Trevor home, but she fell in love with him and stayed with him in America to fight evil and injustice. Wonder Woman has super strength, super speed, the ability to fly in more recent years, but aside from that, she has a host of useful weapons, such as the Lasso of Hestia, also known as the Lasso of Truth. She has her Bracelets of Victory, which are made from pieces of the shield of the King of Gods himself, Zeus. She also has a magic sword known as God Killer, and her tiara is a razor-sharp magical boomerang. Because of her magical weapons, she poses a decent threat to Superman, despite not necessarily being as strong as him. She has, however, gone toe-to-toe with the likes of Shazam and Supergirl. Her bout with Shazam ended in the draw, but she straight-up stomped Supergirl's ass. In the more recent storylines of the DC Universe, Wonder Woman has been revealed not to be made of clay, but actually to be the love child of Queen Hippolyta and the god Zeus, making her a full-blown demigod, and more recently, the actual goddess of war. After her and Steve Trevor broke up due to either Steve dying or them just parting ways, depending on which version of the story you read in the comics, she decided to upgrade to the likes of Superman himself. They are known as DC's power couple. Wonder Woman's main arch enemies are Ares, the god of war, her brother, Cheetah. Several women have used this code name. Some of them were just crazy women wearing a cheetah costume. Others were mutated. Some of those women were Priscilla Rich, who was the Golden Age Cheetah. She was a woman suffering from multiple personality disorder. Deborah Damon, the Silver Age Cheetah, is the niece of Priscilla Rich, who was brainwashed into taking over the mantle. And then you have Barbara Ann Minerva, the post-crisis cheetah and the current bearer of the name. She was a British archaeologist who was bestowed with the powers of the cheetah during a ritual by the god Urzakataga. She also killed Aphrodite with Wonder Woman's sword, Godslayer. Wonder Woman also made an enemy of the Witch of Aea, Cersei, a powerful and immortal sorceress, believing Wonder Woman to be the other witch featured in a prophecy by the goddess Hecate. Cersei devoted herself to destroying Diana. The very first time Wonder Woman was ever portrayed off of the comic book page was actually in the animated Brady Bunch spinoff, The Brady Kids, voiced by Jane Webb. Later, she would be voiced by Shannon Farron and Connie Caulfield in Justice Friends, B.J. Ward in the Superman cartoon series, Susan Eisenberg in Justice League and Justice League Unlimited. In the movie Justice League The New Frontier, Diana is voiced by none other than Xena the Warrior Princess, Lucy Lawless. Kerry Russell voiced Diana in the 2009 animated film Wonder Woman. And finally, Michelle Monaghan voiced Diana in the 2014 Justice League War animated film. She has been portrayed in live-action TV movies by Kathy Lee Crosby in 1974, but that movie was more like James Bond and Diana Prince. She was also portrayed by the most synonymous person who played her in live-action in the 1974 TV movie and subsequent series Wonder Woman, Linda Carter. In 2011, Adrian Palicki filmed a pilot for a Wonder Woman TV series that didn't take off. Now, Wonder Woman is portrayed on screen by Gal Gadot. She is doing the character a great justice. The DCEU Wonder Woman film is one of the only ones I honestly have no complaints about. Though, if I'm being honest, that could be because before preparing for this episode, I wasn't that familiar with the source material. My earliest memories of Wonder Woman come from going to stay with my grandparents, Carl and Patty, and watching the old Linda Carter TV series and the Justice Friends cartoon, where she had her invisible jet, which is no longer relevant because she has the ability to fly now, but the invisible jet used to be the way the squad got around. Super convenient. The invisible boatmobile is sort of a parody of that. And I guess it's because I was a boy and Wonder Woman was a female that I didn't connect with the character. And I don't know what some of my listeners are going to say about that, whether that's sexist or not, but I think that honestly, at that time, that was where it was. I could never really put myself into the female mindset when it came to fiction stuff like that for a long time. I loved Dan Brown's books, but when I read Digital Fortress, which is written from a female perspective, I didn't really like it. And then eventually I read, and everyone's going to laugh at me, but I don't care. I was grounded, and my English teacher in 10th grade loaned me the Twilight series. And I read all three of the books in the week that I was grounded, and I actually enjoyed those, even though they're from the perspective of a female. And then I later realized that's because Dan Brown's a man, and men don't know how to write women in fiction. So I think that's that. But in my now that I went back and watched the Wonder Woman movie for the first time a few weeks ago, and it was really good. Like, Wonder Woman, the DCEU movie, I'll say the same thing about it that I have to say about Aquaman. They were good movies. Like, they were good standalone movies, and the connection to the larger DCEU doesn't really matter. They were just really good movies, and I look forward to the sequels for both of those going forward. And I think that the Snyder Cut, I know I've swooned about the Snyder Cut in basically every episode of this podcast since I found the news out, but I'm looking forward to it. Gal Gadot's Wonder Woman was introduced in Batman vs. Superman, which is weird because they introduced Batman in that, and now they introduced so many characters in that movie that it felt overflowed, and it never quite got fleshed out fully because of the way the direction of Justice League went down. But I think that everything's gonna kind of come together, and no matter what way you look at it, the DCEU is definitely not as big of a clusterfuck as the X-Men franchise. Shout out Bryan Singer, who is also a creepy Hollywood pedophile. You made some fucking shitty movies, bud, and you should be in prison. But anyway, the cartoon versions of Wonder Woman were cool, but the only ones I really, really remember other than Justice Friends are the Justice League and Justice League Unlimited versions, and those shows were cool because they would, like, cycle through episodic centers of each member of the Justice League until it got to Unlimited, because that just, the roster of that show was fucking crazy. But she was always, like, strong and badass. I remember thinking she was Superman's girlfriend way before that was ever established in canon. And I just think that overall she's a really great character, not just for girls to read, you know, but I think men can learn a lot from reading those. And when, I'm about to get into the, I don't want to say too much about the character of Wonder Woman until I get into her creation and everything, so that I can, like, piece together where facets of Wonder Woman came from the creation, which is really interesting. So I guess I'm going to go ahead and get into that, but I just thought I'd share my memories of the character. Like I said, until I started researching it, I wasn't that familiar with anything other than, oh yeah, she's super strong and is almost as strong as Superman, and I remember the Invisible Jet. So most of the information you're going to hear in this episode is from stuff I've learned researching it. But before I get into that, I was talking about Cheetah earlier, and the new Wonder Woman movie is coming out called Wonder Woman 1984, which is a sequel to the first Wonder Woman, yet a prequel to Batman vs. Superman and Justice League. And no, it's a sequel to the first Wonder Woman, yes. But in that movie, Kristen Wiig is going to play Cheetah, so that's going to be interesting. She's going to be one of the mutated versions of Cheetah. So anyway, I'm going to get right into Professor Marston, the man who created Wonder Woman, and his interesting, eccentric life. Wonder Woman was credited to be created by William Moulton Marston. Marston was born in the Cliftondale section of Sagas, Massachusetts. The son of Annie Dalton and Frederick William Marston, he was educated at Harvard University, graduating Phi Beta Kappa with a PhD in psychology. While a student at Harvard, Marston sold his first script, The Thief, to filmmaker Alice Guy Blanche, who directed the film in 1913. After teaching at American University in Washington, D.C., and Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts, Marston traveled to Universal Studios in California in 1929, where he spent a year as the director of public services and taught at the University of Southern California. Marston was the creator of the systolic blood pressure test and the lie detector test, which make sense when you think of his later creation of the lasso of Hestia, which, when wrapped around a subject, is forced to tell the truth. All of Marston's work had a co-collaborator, though, his wife Elizabeth Marston. In fact, she was the one credited with first making the connection between emotions and blood pressure. From his psychological work, Marston became convinced that women were more honest than men in certain situations, and could work faster and more accurately. During his lifetime, Marston championed the latent abilities and causes of the woman to this day. While Marston was a professor, he came in contact with a young TA at his university named Mary Olive Byrne. She would help the professor gain access to the power play domination rituals of sorority initiation. Mary Byrne's mother was Ethel Byrne. Her aunt was Margaret Sanger. These two activists are the ones who opened the very first birth control clinic in the United States. Byrne entered her freshman year at Tufts University studying medicine at her mother's bidding. By the end of the school year, she had been initiated into the sorority Alpha Omegacron Pi. She had a distinctively androgynous appearance with a short Eton crop and was known around campus for her connection to Sanger. She worked at Sanger's Clinical Research Bureau over Christmas vacation. Byrne met William and Elizabeth Marston in 1925, while she was a senior attending Tufts University. William was her psychology professor, and she soon became his research assistant, even taking him to her sorority to do some of his research. She was instrumental in introducing him to the world of sorority baby parties, in which freshman girls are required to dress like babies and are treated like children, in which he performed some of his experiments on human reactions to power. Following her graduation, she moved in with the Marstons and planned to begin a doctoral program in psychology. You may be thinking that it's kind of inappropriate for a student to move in with her psychology professor and her wife, and that's because I left out a crucial part of her relationship with William Marston. When they first started working together, it was mostly an academic relationship. However, later on, with permission from his wife, Marston engaged in a sexual relationship with Olive Byrne. Eventually, other than just approving of the relationship, Elizabeth joined in to this sexual relationship, and they would experiment with bondage and tying people up. Professor Marston himself liked to be tied up by the women, and she moved in with them because they became I believe the term is polycule, a three-person polycule, and that is how Professor Marston ended up with two women living in his house. Ultimately, though, she dropped out of her program to care for the first of Elizabeth's children, Pete Marston. That same year, William published Emotions of Normal People, a defense of the many sexual taboos. Using much of Byrne's original research she had done for her doctorate, and dedicated the work to five women, Byrne included. It received almost no attention from the rest of the academic community, other than a review written by Byrne herself under her alternate name, Olive Richard, in the Journal of Abnormal and Social Psychology. That November, she married both William and Elizabeth Marston, wearing wide-band bracelets on each arm instead of a ring representing William and Elizabeth. These bracelets would later serve as the inspiration for the bracelets on Wonder Woman herself. They referred to November 21st as their anniversary. In 1931, she had her first son by Marston, and the next year she had her second and final. In 1935, both boys were officially adopted by the Marstons. She began working as a staff writer for the Family Circle that same year, writing under her Richard name. Her first article was about Marston, his polygraph, and her experience meeting him and his children, without mentioning her relation to him or that the two of them had children together. She helped type many of Marston's Wonder Woman scripts as well. Now, Mary Olive Byrne's two sons did not know that William Moulton Marston was their father until after his death. They did get adopted eventually, but the Marstons lied to the Census Bureau saying that Byrne was Elizabeth's widowed sister, and she lied. They lied to William's mother by saying that she was their widowed maid. And that's how they got along with the facade. While talking to his wives one day, Professor Marston proposed the idea of a new kind of superhero, one who fought evil and injustice, not with fists, but with love, to which his wife Elizabeth responded, "As long as it's a woman." When creating Wonder Woman, William Moulton Marston combined facets of both of his wives and loves into the character. He made her brilliant like his wife and beautiful like, I guess, his other wife. She wore the bracelets the olive burn wore to signify their marriage. She ruled with love. Now, other than all of those aspects of his wife's personality being imbued into the comics, one of the things that made it into the pages of the comic books, which went weirdly overlooked in the 1940s, you know, no one really thought about it, was the propensity for bondage and the fact that Wonder Woman would constantly get tied up with her own lasso or with other rope, and that it was pretty clear if you go back and look at the old Wonder Woman comic books that she was enjoying it. Granted, you could read it or take in the visualization of it as her just laughing at the fact that she's being tied up when she is a demigod with the power to give Superman a run for his money. But it was talked to by Professor Marston eventually about how he didn't think that putting that sort of stuff in the comic books would promote it in children and that would go largely unnoticed, which I guess it was. It's only recently been talked about. Now, while Professor Marston is credited with coming up with Wonder Woman and writing most of her stories, he wasn't the only one. His wives definitely helped him, and they actually wrote the stories under a pseudonym called Charles Marston, and they collaborated quite frequently. The shitty thing about Wonder Woman and... Well, it's not a shitty thing. I'm getting ahead of myself. Throughout the beginning of her existence, she was a champion for women and women's rights and progressiveness and showing just what a true force women could be and how, according to Professor Marston, they were the superior of the sexes. When Professor Marston died, however, Joy Hummel took over as a ghostwriter for Wonder Woman. And the powers that be in charge of the comic book, now that Professor Marston was gone and couldn't protect his work and the material that he worked on, and his wife basically had no say in it, they relegated Diana Prince from being the badass Amazonian warrior, demigod, super strong badass to literally being a fucking secretary for years. For I think 2 years after Professor Marston died, they literally just relegated Wonder Woman to being a fucking secretary. She answered phones. And I think that is just a testament to the minds of the masses in the 40s and early 50s, and that it, Professor Marston, his wives, and the character of Wonder Woman were way ahead of their time. And in recent years, she's definitely been portrayed more toward the way I believe Professor Marston would want her to. A lot of people argue about the over-sexualization of Wonder Woman in her scantily clad uniform, but that's just not only... Like, to take Professor Marston and his wife's proclivities out of the entire situation, comic books are synonymous with scantily clad women and over-sexualization, especially during the time period when the Magnificent Seven of Image Comics were still working at Marvel, and they were literally tracing frames of pornos and drawing the X-Men chicks over top of that, you know, like it's just synonymous with the craft, and it is what it is. And I don't think that people should, you know, especially with Professor Marston, his whole point was, you know, that women are powerful and the superior sex, and he wanted to showcase that with Wonder Woman. And when he died, they suppressed that, and it's really fucked up. But now his story is more widely known. I actually believe they came out with a biographical movie called Professor Marston and the Wonder Women, about the three-person polycule behind the most significant female superhero in comic book, cartoon, and movie history. And I think everyone should go check that out. I'm probably going to watch it. I haven't seen it yet. This is all just from research based on... I got the idea in my head because I briefly, while getting ready for work, before Leilani was born, saw a sci-fi documentary about the daughter, the granddaughter of Elizabeth Marsden. But as far as Wonder Woman as a character goes, she's part of DC's big three of the fucking, the Trinity of DC, you know. She's right up there on the pedestal with Batman and Superman. She literally came out, I think, a year after Superman and 2 years after Batman. Like, she's been around as long as the main, like, she's just synonymous with comic books, especially with DC. And while I wasn't familiar with it growing up, other than the TV series that I did see, I never really read the comic books. I think that it's worth going back, and I think I'm going to check out a couple key issues. And the movie was really cool, and her story is awesome. The fact that she's so intertwined with the Greek gods is nice, because one of my favorite Marvel aspects is that the Norse gods are incorporated, so I think that's a nice little mirrored thing there. But basically, you know, Professor Marsden and his wives created Wonder Woman. They built her up as a proponent to further love and acceptance throughout the world, and especially to spread the message of feminism. And as soon as the old man died, they just fucked it all up. You know, eventually it got back to its roots, but it's a fucked up story, and I think everyone should look into it. It's definitely got me wanting to go back and check out Wonder Woman, and I feel a little guilty for abandoning an entire, like, sect of the history of comics due to my own gender bias, I guess. I don't really know. But that's the end of the Some Scumbag Comic Books, Wonder Woman, Bondage, and Sexism episode. I hope you guys enjoy it. It's a little bit short this time. I apologize. I'm kind of tired. I got to work tomorrow. But it was a solo episode, which some of you have been asking for. I've been doing a lot of guest episodes. So here's a solo episode for you guys. I'm going to get some more episodes out to you next week. I'm probably not going to pump out as many as I have in this last week every week, but I'm going to definitely try to keep getting you guys some distractions from the hell that is plaguing the earth at the moment. And before I get off of here, I just want to address something that has been bothering me. You know, I've talked about the child sex trafficking and child abuse and the cannibalistic murder cabal running the government and everything. And I just, you know, those are, you hear those terms and you think of, like, oh, crazy stuff and everything. And I saw a lot of posts today, because child sex trafficking is finally trending. It's finally trending after all of this time, due to some laws trying to normalize pedophilia, right? Now, one of the things that I saw during my perusing of the internet was a lot of people talking about how, you know, Pizzagate's not real, there is no satanic child sex cult, but child trafficking is real. And I just kind of want to talk about it a little bit, because while, you know, Pizzagate, I think, was named that to sort of steer people away from looking into it, because it does sound ridiculous. But the underlying information in the emails Hillary Clinton let out, like John Podesta and Hillary Clinton's aide literally were talking to each other about sacrificing a chicken to the god Moloch, right? The child sacrificing god Moloch. That's a thing that actually was said in the fucking emails. Hillary Clinton knows about it. She said it's a thing, you know, that's in there. They're talking about sacrificing a chicken. But the FBI has come out and said that these motherfuckers use food as a code word for kids. That's a real thing, like pizza, hot dog, all this stuff. Jay Malafont is from Comic Ping Pong. I could tell you how to go look into his fucking Instagram and look at all this shady shit that just is still up to this day. I could get into Chrissy Teigen and her thing. I can get into Tom Hanks and all the broad conspiratorial strokes of this shit that I could get into that there is validity for. But instead, what I'm going to talk about is the whole satanic cult aspect of it. And it's not a satanic cult, okay? But it is definitely a death cult, you know? They're worshipping fucking Kronos or Set or Moloch or Baal. You know, you can literally trace this fucking cult back to the Sabbateans, you know, which came about in 1666 by Sabbatai Zevi,
who was a Jewish rabbi who proclaimed to be the Jewish Messiah. And in that same year, 1666, he converted to Islam. And you can trace all of this stuff from, you can literally trace back from Hillary Clinton's emails to the Sabbateans and pass that to the cults that worship Baal and Moloch and all of these things. And there are these linear stories throughout different religions about these child sacrifice demons, Baal, Moloch, Balaam, stuff like that. And then there's also a child sacrifice demon. I use a demon in a broad stroke because that's not a Christian term. It doesn't have to do with Christianity or Satanism. I'm showing the broad strokes across all of theology, right? And then there's a child sacrifice god called Balaam Moloch, which is literally just the fucking combination of Baal, Balaam, Moloch. It's the same shit, right? All of those entities are representative of Kronos, the ancient titan from Greek mythology. And these people believe that if they can rape and terrorize children and eat their adrenochrome, which is in their blood, once they get terrified to a certain point, you know, there's lots of hardcore evidence of this, and there's literally a video of Hillary Clinton and her fucking aide terrorizing a little girl and ripping her fucking face off and like playing with her intestines in front of her and drinking the blood on the dark web somewhere. Don't go look for that because you're gonna get caught up and fucked, but it's out there, I promise you. They're not worshiping Satan. They're worshiping something much older and much darker, and they believe in magic with a fucking K, and they're doing these rituals. You know, it's in the architecture of Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. and the Vatican and the City of London are like the three fucking city-states that exist in the entire world, and all of the architecture for those are the same. There are tons of connections that you can trace back throughout history if you want to go look for it. And I'm not telling you to. I don't give a fuck if you believe anything. I'm saying it doesn't matter if you believe that there's a murder cabal or a murder cult or anything. Well, what I can tell you is that they do exist, and that these people believe that they are worshiping Kronos or Baal, Balaam, Moloch, whatever the fuck name they want to ascribe to this fucking, like, black cube of Saturn deity that they're fucking worshiping. They believe in it. They believe it's real. And they have for thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. And it is all connected. To say that there is no overarching conspiracy, there's just child sex trafficking. That's the whole point of everything. It's all connected to Jeffrey Epstein and the fucking subterranean submarine tunnels, Ghislaine Maxwell being a submarine pilot, the Clintons, it's all there. There are connections. And you can fucking scoff and be like, oh, you're just saying a bunch of random shit, because I don't have time to go into every aspect of every connection to you guys. I fucking don't. And I will try to do an episode on this shit, but I've been trying to stay away from it. But there's a lot to it, and it's fucking real. Just look into it. Or don't. I don't give a fuck. But acknowledge it. Acknowledge it's weird. Acknowledge there's weird shit. Don't fucking start talking about something you haven't researched at all. Or do. I don't know. I'm getting a little worked up. This is a fucked up subject. And I apologize, but there's a lot of fucked up shit happening in the world, and I think that we should pay attention, and we should actually come together and do something, because we cannot make change while we're divided, and right now, everyone is divided, and the only things that keep happening in the world are things that are dividing us more, and I won't fucking stand for it, and I hope you guys don't stand for it, too. I hope we can all come together and rise up out of this fucking cesspool of existence that is existence, and we can form it and make it better. We can literally live in heaven on earth if we all just project that reality into existence. With that giant ball of negative bullshit all being said, everybody, love everybody, and in the words of the immortal Bill Hicks, who I wish were still alive to guide us through this dark and desperate time, it's just a ride. Have a good night, guys.